Welcome to Earl Tom's podcast. Today we're going to talk about how to write a contract. You've already heard from us, you know, how to find buyers, sellers, wholesale in a legal way. So now that you have that information, you need to understand what you need to have in a contract to make sure that your interests are covered, that you don't get in any trouble when you write the contract, and also how to kind of extend the contract without actually extending it. It's all, you know, in the language written in the contract. So what we want to start with a contract is really simple. You start with the contract date. You always date it somewhere at the top, maybe the top paragraph, something like that. This contract was written on this day. But you also want to have, you know, your buyer and seller listed. You know, a lot of times when you come across these deals, it may be an inherited property or a foreclosure, something that, you know, you're not necessarily sure what the how the seller is listed in the courthouse, because a lot of times your tax assessment won't show up. So when you're searching your courthouse records, or your owner thinks, well, it's in this name, well, it may not actually be recorded that way just yet. So what you do to get around this is just write in seller of record. And that'll tell the attorney, you know, do the research, and then whoever, you know, is listed as far as the seller, let's just go with that. But part of that also is whoever is selling it actually has the permission to sell it. So when you come in with an estate, you know, it may be listed the estate of such and such, but did they prorate it? Do they have the ability to actually sell it? A lot of people will say, I'll just give you a quitclaim deed. Well, what you run into a lot of times with a quitclaim deed is all that really means is someone is transferring their rights to that property. That doesn't mean that everything is free and clear, that they actually have the ability to sell it. So somebody in the family may have written a quitclaim deed to another family member, but they never recorded it. So what you wind up having to do in those situations is they actually have to go back, find the quitclaim deed, and then you do what's called a stacking the deeds on top of it. The attorney will file the quitclaim deed first and then record your deed. When you're looking at these deeds, though, there are the deeds are very simple. A lot of people call a quitclaim deed quick. It's not Q-U-I-C-K. It's Q-U-I-T. It means they're quitting their rights. So the other side of it is a warranty deed. A warranty deed is the exact same thing as, say, a contractor, electrician, somebody coming over doing some repairs on the property and giving you a warranty on their work. That property is now warrantied the exact same way that a contractor would warranty their work. Real estate in its most simplest form is exactly that. It's simple. People have convoluted it to the point to where it gets confusing. But when you look at things in a very simple way, you have a quit, I quit. You have a warranty, I warrant this property, whether it's a special, general, doesn't matter. There is still a warranty on that deed. So when you go through this process, you need to actually figure out with the seller what type of deed they actually have. You know, a lot of times it's not gonna matter because they have a warranty deed, but it doesn't hurt to ask, because if they don't know, then you could wind up having some trouble down the road. If they've got a mortgage on the property, you can almost bet they have a warranty deed, because I don't know any mortgage companies out there that are going to write a mortgage on a quitclaim deed. So with that said, we're going to move to one thing that a lot of wholesalers struggle with. The legal aspect of it, as far as earnest money goes, on all of my contracts, I write $100. And the reason that I write $100 is because that gives the ability to quiet, if somebody goes in and tries to quiet the title Now it actually shows that money, and not a substantial amount, but enough to cloud that title. A lot of people will go out there and just put $10 on it. Every single attorney out there that sees $10 as an earnest money is going to override that and go ahead and close that deal. So you will get passed over. You will lose the ability to cloud that title when you put $10 on that contract. So always make sure that you put at least $100 on that contract as far as earnest money, and that you actually deliver that earnest money to the attorney. Because if anything ever comes of it and that attorney has to testify or get involved, they get deposed, and they say, well, no, they didn't actually deposit this in my account. Well, now you've lost all the ability to get paid on that contract if the seller breached the contract. So you always have to make sure that even though it's written on the contract, that you're actually following through and putting it on the contract. Another aspect of it is your closing date. With mine, I always do at least 30 days. It doesn't always take 30 days, but I like to have that ability for a couple of different reasons. Number one is it gives, you know, a buyer the opportunity to go out, look at it themselves. A lot of times buyers want to bring a contractor after they've seen it, expressed interest in it. So they have to have the ability for that contractor to go out there, write up an estimate. And I don't know how many times that, you know, you've actually flipped a house or wholesaled these houses, but when a contractor comes out there, most times they're not going to give a turnaround of the same day, next day of an estimate, because they're out there, you know, swinging a hammer, doing what they've got to do, looking at other projects. So they've got to actually have time in the office to be able to type that estimate up. And that actually does take a little bit of time to do it. So typically your contractors will give the estimate back to your investors 3 to 5 days after they've looked at it. So by giving that, you've basically lost a week if you have an investor go look at it, you know, the next day after you put it under contract. Another reason for the 30 days is because if there is an issue with the title or the seller's ability to convey that property to you, it gives them enough time to actually remedy that, so that we don't have to go through and write extensions and people get frustrated, get stressed out. Well, I'm not going to be able to close it by this time. You know, and all of that is avoided most times if you just put the 30 days on there. And when you explain it to a seller, you explain it in that way. I'm, you know, just in case, I don't think there's anything that's going to stop you from selling it, but just in case title finds something, this gives us enough time to have that fixed. And then we can get to the closing table. You know, I can put money in your pocket. Once we get the title back, we'll know for sure. Usually the title's back in, you know, 7 days, 2 weeks, something like that. So you're already buying time trying to say that the title might take a little while, but at the same time, it may come back in 2-3 days. So if you tell your seller it's come back, that's completely up to you. Usually I won't tell a seller that the title is ready until I actually have a buyer ready to close on it, because all that does in the seller's mind is think, okay, title's back, we're ready to close, give me my money. So when you start stretching it out, you know, 20 more days, they're wondering why you're doing that. So it's important to understand the process behind it of why you're stretching these things the way that you are. One thing that I always do in my contracts, it's so easy to do that sellers typically don't even care, but I always write in my contract, instead of a 10-day inspection period, I put a 21-day inspection period. But I also put in there that it excludes holidays and weekends. So essentially what I've done is taken my inspection period the full 30 days. So if I don't have a buyer by that 30 days, I'm still under my inspection period and I can back out. You know, the seller will keep the $100, but at the same time, I would rather the seller keep the $100 than have to, you know, go through the process of, oh, you owe me $100 and this and that. And the next thing you know, you get a phone call from an attorney saying they're going to sue you, do all these other things. So that's another reason that you put the $100 in the closing attorney, the title attorney's account, is so if you do have to back out of it, it's just over at that point. There's nothing else. And how you make that over at that point is you put a paragraph, a clause in there, a disclaimer that basically says if the buyer breaches the contract for any reason, the seller is entitled to the earnest money but has no other courses of action against the buyer. It's resolved right then and there. When the buyer breaches the contract, says I'm not going to buy it, even if it's after the inspection period, then you get $100 and we go our separate ways and it's over at that point. How you actually accomplish that is that you have another clause in the contract that basically says the buyer and the seller both are voluntarily signing this contract and understand what it means, that the seller has been afforded the opportunity to have this contract reviewed by an attorney. If they choose to do it, that's up to them. 9 out of 10 sellers are not going to do that. But that clause is in there that says they have been afforded the opportunity to consult with an attorney prior to signing this contract. If they go ahead and sign it, they've basically agreed that $100 is all they're going to get. So to drop it from that point on, because then when they go and they put that contract in front of an attorney, the attorney's going to go, it says in here that you could have called me before you signed this, but you didn't. So now you're stuck with it, and it's over. One of the ways that you have to make sure in your contract that everything is up front, that you're not going to have any hidden surprises, is another clause that basically says that there are no liens or encumbrances on this property. And really all that means is an encumbrance is a lien, a deed restriction, easements, encroachments. And what those things are, a deed restriction is really simple. You're sitting there, take the FHA investor flip rule. You can only sell a property for 5% more within 90 days, or you can't sell it. That's a deed restriction. If you think of an encroachment, basically that's somebody's putting their fence a foot inside the property line. That's all that really means, is somebody is encroaching on that property. If you've got, you know, an easement that somebody is sharing, a lot of times you'll have a house at the front of the road, and then somebody, a family member, decides that they want to build, you know, on the property behind the house. So now they've just cut a driveway, you know, to the back of the property. So now you may have 2 acres, a house behind one, but now they share that driveway. So you actually have to sell that property with that easement involved in it. That doesn't mean that you can't sell that property with that easement involved in it. What an encroachment does is it's kind of like adverse effects to the property. One of the things that you have to watch out for is, does it decrease the value? So if you've got, you know, an easement that you're sharing and somebody is developing a neighborhood behind it, so now your driveway has turned into a main road that's, you know, you're going to have cars constantly coming in and out of when you're leaving, but you're not actually a part of that neighborhood, does that increase your value or does it decrease your value? You have to watch out for those things. One of the things that most don't put in their contract or don't phrase it the correct way is when you write a contract and you have the right to inspect that property, whether they want to give you a lockbox and tell you to call them every single time that you're going out there to look at it, but you have to have the ability to put your buyers, their contractors, real estate agents, home inspectors, whoever it may be, has to have the ability to go to that property in a timely fashion so that you can get that property, that deal closed within 30 days. it gets real hard to do when you have a property that's already occupied by a tenant, because you have to give that tenant, you know, say 48, 72 hours, depending on where you are, of notice before you can go into it. Some tenants don't care. They'll say, you know, come on. But when you're trying to get this closed, how agreeable your seller is for access to that property depends a lot on whether or not you're going to be able to get that property closed within that 30 days. So you have to stress to that seller, I'm going to have contractors coming in here giving me a bid. You know, if everything comes back on that bid the correct way, then I'm going to have a home inspector come, look at it, tell me if, you know, if there's anything that we can't see. Because one thing that I always tell sellers is I can see, I can estimate in my own mind, and a contractor can estimate visible areas. So when an inspector's coming, they're climbing in the attic, they're, you know, checking things between the walls, they're going under the house, they're checking things that are not technically visible. So that's just another layer of kind of doing your due diligence, but also buying you time to get everything situated. Because if you don't phrase it like that, your buyer may require an inspection, they may not, but you put it out there in order to have that ability, that expectation from the seller knows that it's coming. So be ready for it, because when you get to that point, whether you need it or not, them already having some kind of advance warning is going to help you in the end. Some of the best news that you can give, you know, a seller is, well, you know, we don't need an inspection. The contractor came over here, you know, they stuck the testers in the outlets, everything, you know, came up fine, tested the plumbing, those kind of things. So we don't actually need an inspection. We're just going to go ahead and go, you know, directly to the close. One of the ways that you actually get the ability to get this property sold, and we have to kind of back up prior to the inspection, but it kind of goes hand in hand, is you put in that contract that you have the ability to assign the property, and you have the ability to list that property, basically market that property. How you word that in your contract is important, but you make sure that you have in that contract that you can, once both sides have signed it, that you can assign the contract and that you can list that property, whether you're sending it to a buyer's list, sending it to an agent to put on an MLS, you list it for sale by yourself on Zillow, Craigslist, if that's where you go, Facebook groups, wherever you're wanting to go, you make sure that you have that in your contract. So when, you know, Tom's neighbor is over there searching the internet, they magically find the house listed for sale. You've got the house under contract for $100,000, but you've got it listed for sale on Zillow for $150,000. And then the neighbor tells Tom, hey, they're trying to sell this house for $150,000. You get a phone call from Tom, hey, what are you doing? Well, sir, I'm just trying to go ahead and see the appetite for this house to see what I might be able to get for it, you know, as is, because I'm in this business to make money. I don't get rich off of every property, but I'm still in the business to make money. It's how I keep my doors open. So if somebody is willing to come in here, you know, and give me $130,000 for it, does that make it worth it for me to go ahead and sell it without renovating it? Or do I want to go ahead and renovate it so that I can get to that $150,000? I'm just testing the waters right now. So you overcome that objection, and it really does make sense, because, you know, if you can find, they would do the exact same thing. If they could, that's why they called you. They didn't want to repair it. So if you can get that done, that's just another avenue for you to actually make money the fastest, instead of actually, you know, having to go through, renovate it, put it on the market, sell it with a real estate agent, or renovate it, get a tenant in it, and then sell it to another investor. So you're maximizing your dollars and your time by trying to get it sold online prior to actually doing anything else and getting it closed. If you have that in your contract, whether the seller gets upset or not, it's not going to matter. But you need to explain it to them in a way that says, you know, hey, you called me because you didn't want to renovate. I'm not saying I won't renovate, but if I can make a dollar or two without having to do it, that's the smartest business decision that I could make. So that helps them understand where you're coming from, but it doesn't mean you're not going to close or you're doing something funny. You don't always tell sellers exactly your intentions, but you don't lie to them either. If they ask you a question, if you tell them a half truth versus a complete lie, that's when you start getting in trouble. Lying will get you in trouble because what you're saying is contrary to what's in that contract. So by you saying, well, sir, I'm trying to see if I can get it sold prior to renovating, that's in that contract. I can list that property. I can assign that property. So if I make $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 off of this, it's in that contract that I can do that. If the seller winds up balking on it and now doesn't want to close it with you because they think they're getting ripped off, the way that you've written this contract now gives you the ability to go record that contract in the courthouse and actually cloud that title because you've got the earnest money. It's been deposited. You've got the seller breach in there. You've got that clause. You've got the, I can assign it. I can list it. You've got the voluntary signatures where everybody was, you know, afforded the opportunity to have this, you know, reviewed by legal counsel. Whether they took it or not is on them. So when an attorney or a title company, once they go and sell it to somebody else, that property is now going to be clouded. And if somebody overwrites that property and insures it, now you actually have claim against that title company plus the seller for the breach of the contract. Because if a seller breaches it because you've got the language in the contract that says you can't do it because I'm afforded all, you know, rights and remedies to make sure that, you know, everybody keeps this contract whole, then you look at the title company and the title company insured it knowing there was that cloud on that title because that contract was recorded with it specifically mentioning that the seller breached their contract. Now, whether you cloud a title and record that is completely up to you. Personally, I never do it because to me that is, it's just kind of bad business to me. That's my own personal opinion. That doesn't matter. That doesn't mean somebody else shouldn't do it. One of the reasons I don't do it is because when I started out, I didn't necessarily have the means to actually close every one of these properties. So I made it a habit to not go all in, so to speak, in the event that I upset someone. They had a friend that was an attorney, said, hey, do this, call the attorney general, call the commission, things like that. I didn't want to get in trouble. I was trying to stay under the radar. And since then, I've actually just kept that same principle about how I do things. Because even though you may cloud that title, if you get a knock on your door and you have to actually prove that you had the means, you did everything the correct way, all of this and that, that's still going to tie you up for a little while, and you're still going to have to pay money out of pocket for an attorney to represent you. But if you don't do it and the seller just, you know, goes ahead and sells it to someone else, you know, that's fine. That was their house. The same way that you have to do what's best for you, they have to do what's best for them. Now, what motivates that action? You can only be responsible for your own actions. So if you do that, and you record that contract, you're responsible for your own actions. If the seller breaches it and tries to sell it anyway, they're responsible for their own actions. So it comes back to how you do business, what you're comfortable with, the risk you're willing to take. But when you write a contract, having all of these things in the contract will help you if anything ever arises. some contingencies that I always put in the contract, and I always write them at the end. I will never use a one-page contract. It just doesn't. It's not going to cover you the way that you need it covered. I know a lot of people use these little one-page contracts to basically just say, I can get out of this if I want to. If that's how you do it, that's just how you do it. Eventually, you'll get out of that habit because something will happen that'll cause you to get out of it. My dad always said it when I was growing up in this business, if you're in this business long enough, you're going to get sued. It's just going to happen. I got sued years ago, but luckily because I was prepared for it simply because of, you know, things that I had learned from my father, that they had no case. They wound up having to drop it. But I still had to pay attorney fees just because somebody was upset. But at that same time, I kind of took it as a badge of honor because I was also always told, if nobody's talking about you, you're not any good. This is a very cutthroat business, so you have to always kind of have one eye over your shoulder to see what you're doing. That's why it's important to worry about your reputation before you worry about anything else. Because once your reputation starts taking a hit, then you're going to have all these other examples of, well, they did this and they did this. In the event you get sued, or you know, you get a knock on the door from the commission or whoever, all these things are going to start adding up, and it's going to be a pattern of behavior. So you may skate on whatever you're facing right then, but you're on somebody's radar now, and they're going to watch you a little bit closer. So you always put your reputation before everything, but you make sure that your documents are in order, they're organized, they have the correct language in them, you do the process the right way, you put the earnest money in, these contingencies that you put in. You know, buyer is going to choose the closing attorney, title company. Seller has to produce a marketable title. There can't be any liens or encumbrances on it. If it's an occupied property and the tenant wants to stay, you write in there, tenant to remain. If you have, you know, if you want to just write it in there without having a paragraph in there, inspection period excludes holidays and weekends. The more you write in as contingencies, the better off you're going to be, because it gives you more outs, and sometimes you're going to need them. And if they're not in that contract and you don't have the habit of putting them in the contract, then you're going to wind up one day facing a situation that you wouldn't have been in had you put those contingencies in there and had you done the language in the contract the correct way. Because every attorney will tell you, it's all how it's contracted and it's all how it's titled in this business. So if you don't have it contracted the correct way and it's not titled the correct way, you have no leg to stand on and you're going to lose every single time. Even though you may think you've got the strongest case, you're still not going to win, and you're going to wind up spending money to figure that out. So with that being said, I want everyone to kind of just think of it in that fever way that I discussed in the previous episode. Don't rush it. Take your time, do it the right way. And even if something does come up, you're not going to be in any trouble because you did it the right way. It was contracted. The language was in there. It was titled the right way. No one is going to be able to do anything to you other than maybe give you a negative review on Google or Facebook or something like that. But when it comes right down to it and you're in front of, say, a judge, you're going to walk out of there with a clean record because your contract, the language in it, was written the right way. You had the right contingencies in there. You put the earnest money down. You don't have anything to worry about. Your dates in the contract were the right way. Everything was on the up and up. The only thing that wasn't on the up and up is how the seller performed. So when you're in front of that, the seller is going to be the one that winds up getting in trouble, not you. So with that, I want to thank everyone for listening to this week's episode. If you've got any questions, feel free to ask them at the link below. If if you need any further advice, I would recommend going over to earltimes.com to check out some more ways to build your business, some of the processes, some of the things that you need to do. And that way you'll actually wind up having a legitimate, sustainable business that keeps you out of trouble. Again, thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week.